The next case on our calendar is 04-738, Elizabeth Kish versus the City of Akron. Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Bruce Christensen, Assistant Director of Law for the City of Akron. I represent the petitioner, the City of Akron. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there, clock.
This matter is before the court pursuant to Rule 18 of the Rules of Practice of the Supreme Court of Ohio on a certification from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals asking this court what constitutes a record as the term is used in Ohio Revised Code Section 149.351. At the onset, I'd like to say that the city recognizes its obligation under the revised code to keep, preserve, and to produce public records. It further recognizes that in this case, it failed to preserve the documents in question. Despite having a records retention policy and schedule, these records were not kept, the policy was not followed, and the records were destroyed. The city recognizes that these documents that were destroyed were in some form encompass a public record. But the question is not, are these public records, but how many? The question before this court is then, what is a record?
Counsel, I'm not quite sure how we got ourselves in this predicament, but the question, you even argued the question we're left to answer is terribly narrow. We were asked to answer several questions. Let me start first by, it seems to me it's really odd to be asked to answer a question that seems so fact-driven after the jury trial is over. How do we get in that position?
I think the reason we're in this position, Your Honor, is that there seems to be a lack of cases that deal with the forfeiture provision of 149.351.
Okay, but did you ask to certify questions after?
No, Your Honor. This came directly. This was on the Sixth Circuit's own.
And the Sixth Circuit decided on their own without counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor.
To submit all these questions.
That is correct, Your Honor.
To us at that point.
And the Sixth Circuit asked us to answer another question. That is, what is a violation under the statute? We didn't have 4 votes to apparently
right.
bring in that question, but we do have to, don't we really have to answer that in order to really give the Sixth Circuit any help here, we really have to answer that too, don't we? Because it comes, we know all the pieces of paper here were a public record, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think violation in the record in 149.351 are so entwined that my fear in this case is if you adopt a broad definition of record, it ties the hands of anybody looking at the violation section without some more interpretation as to what is a violation.
Counsel, the reason I raise that, and the chief's in the clear on this, according to my records, because he voted to take some more issues. I didn't vote to take any
That's
of them.
That's why I can speak about it so freely.
is reading the amicus brief of the Newspaper Association, I'm not even sure that they suggest the answer to this. They just suggest a whole lot of different fact patterns in which a record in some cases would be a single thing, and in other cases it would be a lot more data. And it would seem to me that this must have been argued over at the trial, and the jury made a determination. Wasn't there a heck of a brawl at the trial over whether this is one record or whether these are each pay period is a record?
Well, I believe at the trial level that the jury instruction, which was objected to by the city that was given, led the jury to believe that each record, each piece of paper, each document in that file was a record. I believe that's error. I believe that our argument before the Sixth Circuit is questioning that. I think that that is one of the reasons why the Sixth Circuit is asking what is a record.
Well, Counselor, don't they really want us to figure out whether a record is, in some very fact-specific cases, is a compilation or whether it's document by document? Because what you had here, from my understanding, is was both. You had a running tally of the results of the comp time, which was the compilation, and that was destroyed. And then you had each document that was filled out by the employee documenting that particular pay period or request for comp time or however that document was created, and those were destroyed. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right, so the compilation was done by accumulating each one of those documents, 800 or 900 of them, and then coming up with the running tally on any given point in time in that employee's compensatory system.
Well, this court has consistently defined a record as not to be based on its form, but on its function. And in this particular case, the function of the individual documents was for the running tally.
Well, the function was to document the time that accrued to that individual.
And to keep that running tally.
No, the compilation was the running tab. The document pertained to the individual on a particular point in time in the employment history. On Tuesday, February 15th, I applied for 3 hours of comp time, or I worked through my lunch, or whatever. You know, so that's the document of what happened on that employment day in the life of that employee. Then another entity kept a running tally here, and that's the compilation. And my understanding was everything was destroyed.
That is true, but it wasn't another entity keeping that tally. What you have to understand is that
it was the employer.
The employer did, but the employer was also the person collecting these pieces of paper that were the individual comp time records. This department was running a program which was, it was not authorized by the city.
Or law.
It was essentially just to allow flex time within the department for they could work through their lunch and then leave it half an hour early or get to work a half an hour late and work through their lunch. But the purpose of the whole thing was to keep the running total of the comp time in the department. All these individual sheets did was reflect what time was used or what time was taken.
But these sheets were created by the employer for the employee to fill out and make application to give the employer notice of what happened on a particular day in relationship to that employee and his or her presence at the site of employment.
That's correct. The purpose is of knowing at what particular time whether or not this person was in arrearance of comp time or had a bonus of comp.
So if there was no compilation done, would your argument be that these individual documents were not business records or public records?
Well, if there was no compilation done, then the argument would be that there maybe was a different function. The facts of this case are what the function of these documents were to keep that running total.
Could you have a running total without these documents?
Yes, you could have a running total if they kept it on a ledger or kept it in a computer that they would report to the person who had the computer and they would type it in. That would have fulfilled.
But that wasn't the system that the city implemented, was it?
That is not the system that the department implemented in this case, no.
Which is the city?
Correct.
Mr. Christians, let me ask you the question given us from the Sixth Circuit that we agreed to answer is what constitutes a record as that term is used in Ohio Revised Code 149.351. How would you have us answer that question in one sentence?
Well, I think
take two if you need them.
I think the best answer to that comes from the amicus brief of the Ohio Municipal League, in which they say a record is a compilation of data or information regardless of the physical form or character that documents a single organization, function, policy, decision, procedure, operation, or other activity of government office. So that in this case, the single document was Akron's compensatory time records, which were destroyed.
That pretty much cites the statute, doesn't it?
Yes, except that,
most of that response cites the statute.
Except what we want to emphasize here, Your Honor, though, is that as the cases of this court have directed, that we look to the function of the document, not to the form of the document.
That's the thrust of your argument. I take it from reading your brief that it's the function of the collection of documents, or the document or documents that you think we should include in our response to the Sixth Circuit. Is that correct?
Correct. And to answer the other side's question as to whether or not, why should the city be the one that gets to decide what the record is? Well, the city is not deciding what the record is. It is the function of that record. All these records serve a purpose to the city. It's one of the reasons we keep them. One of the reasons we have to have them is because we use them. We have to have them in a form that makes sense to us.
Council, they also serve a purpose to the employee. Following up on Justice O'Connor's, the employee fills out a timesheet, and they do that every pay period. And if you throw, in this case, the book away, but retain the timesheets, the employee is still in a position to make their case that I've not been properly paid, and the timesheets are here to show it. But if you throw away, each timesheet that you throw away conceivably destroys a critical record, critical to the employee, presumably critical to the city as well, because it is the basic information under which you establish whether or not the pay has been appropriate for the time period in question.
I'm not arguing that these records should have been destroyed or could have been destroyed. It was wrong to destroy them.
We understand you stipulate that.
And to the degree that those records might be lost, yes, there may be some harm done. But I think when you look at the overall scheme of what's supposed to go on here under 149.351, that if we get to the point where each piece of paper in a file is a record for purposes of the forfeiture statute.
Well, I think Mr. Marburger for the Newspaper Association points out lots of examples in which each piece of paper would not be a record, but also circumstances in which they would be a record. And that's, it seems to me, what makes answering this question in the abstract almost impossible. A much easier question, it seems to me, would be for the Sixth Circuit to look at what the jury was told and decide whether or not they were given the proper instruction.
But for us to
answer this question in the abstract, don't we almost have to go clear back to that jury instruction and try to wrap an opinion around that? And that gets us way beyond the question we were asked.
No, I don't believe so, because I think what the Sixth Circuit is asking for is just some guidance on what a definition that they can use so that they can apply the facts to the case. And I believe that the definition that I gave you from the Ohio Municipal League's amicus curiae brief, which is very similar to ours, but I like their wording a little bit better, it gets more complete and would make a better rule of law, would assist them in applying the facts of the case to the law that we're asking you to.
What's wrong with the definition that's found in 149.011 of record? Includes any document, device, or item, regardless of physical form or characteristic, including an electronic record, et cetera, created and received by or coming under the jurisdiction of a public office. I think the word any is very important to this case.
And Judge, I agree that that's a good start. It's a good start. But the case law, this court has consistently defined a record not by its form, but its function. And I think that we need to go beyond this definition in the revised code and apply what this court has said in cases like Whitmore and Margolis to give some direction to the Sixth Circuit.
It is a case-by-case determination of what is a record.
No, I think what the legislature left out when defining records was the confusion that's going to come from using plural and singular words. A record means many things to many different people, but a record certainly can be one piece of paper or a book.
Counsel, let me put this in fairly practical terms. A public records request is made of the city of Akron or the state of Ohio for the home address and telephone number of every employee. Presumably, the city of Akron or the state of Ohio would maintain a master list of such information, but presumably it would also be in the individual employment files of each employee. So is it one record if the master list is thrown away? Is it 50,000 other records if that information is destroyed for each employee out of their individual employment file? Same information.
Well, if the master file were to destroy it, it would be one record.
Right. That's easy.
Yes.
Okay, now what happens if it's destroyed for each employee?
Then for each employee, that would be a record for each employee. But that's not this case. Those are all coming from separate. It's similar to Margolis, and it's similar to Swigert case, where the government body is taking information from many sources and putting it into one. And the court has said that there's value to that, and that becomes a public record because of the value that passes on to the citizens.
Counsel, based on Justice Pfeiffer's argument or example that was just given, you said if it's a compilation of the the list created, that's one record. But if each individual's address page was removed and destroyed, that would be certainly a violation for each employee. Now, what you have, what we have here, is essentially the same thing, a compilation of a running list and each individual docket pertaining to a separate function, and you are arguing function, being destroyed. How can you distinguish those two?
Well, with all due respect, I don't think it's the same. I think, as I was explaining, that those records are all taken from records that already exist. I'm taking them from my file, I'm taking it from my associate's file. These are all separate records that already exist, coming from the many to the one. These files, these comp files, all are coming from one source, the employee himself, putting those tickets, those pieces of paper, into his file or her file to keep that running total. So the difference is that these are being created by one source, not many sources. And again, the function of collecting these things and to have them was to have a running total. And I see my time.
So your split on the facts of your case would be it's a record, the books, one record, and then each employee's comp file is a separate record, but not each time sheet for each pay period.
That's correct. And
you would have the number of records you would have would be what in this case? Three? Two employees in the book?
Yes. And I'd like to clear up one thing. I see my time's up, but these weren't based on pay periods. These were a continuous running total. There was no the only conceivable end there might be in the situation or collection or compilation might be the year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Ms. Corso.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Corso, and I represent the respondents, Elizabeth Kish and Victoria Elder, who are with us today in court. Mr. Warner Mendenhall, my co-counsel, is also present today. The one issue that I feel compelled to clear up right at the start of this is the fallacy that there was only one function to these documents. Now, we keep on calling them comp time documents, but really the form, if you look, it's Plaintiff's Exhibit 1 within the trial record. The definition, or I'm sorry, the caption is leave and comp time forms. There were 8 separate blanks to fill out on this form as to why you were using the form. Using accruing or using comp time were only 2 of the 8. So there are 6 other reasons. 75% of the document did not have to do with comp time. It had to do with funeral leave, sick time, vacation time, a general other category, and others that are listed there. The reason it's important to state this is because the comp time accrued for Ms. Kish and Ms. Elder in this case, they were union members under the CSPA. Comp time accrued on a daily basis, not weekly, such as the Fair Labor Standards Act requires. If you were absent for an entire day, if you took a sick day or a vacation day, that form in itself had absolutely nothing to do with comp time because you weren't there for an entire day. Comp time only came into play for partial absences. So this piece of paper, these forms, did not serve one singular purpose or function as the city has tried to maintain. It's also evident in the fact that there's a CC list on the bottom with, I think, about 7 or 8 initials. That is every single employee in the department. Now, this was all
Counsel,
testified to.
If you were to be seeking just one employee's file,
yes.
Employee's been there maybe 10 years, and employee leaves, and a year later, 2 years later, somebody's cleaning out desks and saying, oh, this person's not here anymore, and they throw it out. Mm-hmm. Your position under the interpretation you seek is that every single paper in that one employee's file constitutes a public record with a separate forfeiture charge.
Yes, I do, ma'am. And the reason that is because each one is created separately, individually, that has meaning in and of itself. Now, some of these documents were then used to create this compilation.
Do we look at all at the legislative purpose for a forfeiture statute? I mean, do we look at the fact that these are public entities that eventually that burden really is spread among the taxpayers, and when you take the what is pretty much an extreme position on your side that every single piece of paper constitutes a record, you could have forfeiture charges of hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases, and you think that that's not anything we should look at, that's
this,
not
to,
an issue.
To clarify, in this particular case, each record was a single-page document. The respondents in this case, the plaintiffs, have never argued that every piece of paper is a separate document in every single case.
That's not my question.
Okay.
My question
I just want to make sure that that's
my
understood.
Question is a public policy. Should we be looking at what is the legislative purpose? Is it truly to assess a forfeiture fine for every single paper, despite the fact that it could run into the hundreds of thousands, or is it, you know, some sort of deterrent factor on a public official? I mean, what do we look at that at all, or are we only subject to a literal interpretation?
Well, I believe there is a strict constructionism aspect to this, the question that is solely before us today. Basically, when you look at whether this is a deterrent factor or whether this is compensatory, how the monetary issues affect the public entity, I believe that the legislature is the entity to address that, not the court. They have done that. They set the penalty, knowing full well. I think a very good example.
Do you think they ever anticipated it being applied per page? Do you think they really considered that when they set this?
I do believe they did. I have to believe they did, because there's nothing in the legislative record that indicates that there was any discussion or fight towards this.
Nor reflecting the opposite,
okay.
Either.
But there are many statutes out there that predated this. Remember, this was rewritten in 1986, so it's a relatively recent statute. There are many statutes out there that call for forfeitures, for penalties, possibly on a per-day thing, where then there is a cap on that. These exist with OSHA. They exist with many different employment or environmental laws. I think one was just recently discussed in the case before you, prior to me coming up here. But there are caps on these. The legislature is smart enough to understand that if they wanted to put a cap on it, they can. House Bill 9 was just recently introduced
unless
in the state legislature.
Unless they didn't anticipate anyone interpreting it the way you had, so they didn't see a need for a cap. But if they perhaps knew that a court would interpret it the way that you are asking, they might have said up to a certain level, because at that point, really, us as the taxpayer then bear that burden of the forfeiture fine.
If you have a large department, for example, of 100 or 200 employees, and every single, or let me take, I used to work for the City of Cleveland Law Department. City of Cleveland had about 7,000, 8,000 employees while I was there. Every single employee has a personnel file. So there could be a wholesale destruction of personnel files. Somebody could come in, take every single file out of that drawer, and destroy it. And in that case, even if the definition was used of a file as opposed to the individual records, you would still have 8,000 violations. I think there are so many instances like that that are within the easy realm of possibility in 1986, when this was written by the legislature, that they couldn't have been blind to it. There's many ways that there could be wholesale destruction.
So your answer is that we do not consider any of the public policy issues or the intent of the legislature. A literal interpretation is all that we look at.
The intent of the legislature is broad access to public records. Access without preservation is meaningless. So I believe that is the intent of the legislature. And again, House Bill 9 that was just introduced addresses this situation. They redefined the penalties or the forfeiture provision for the failure to comply with a public records request. They put a $250 per day forfeiture capped at $5,000 and then added an additional $1,000, I don't know if it was per day or per violation, with absolutely no cap if there was willful, egregious violation. Okay? They did not touch 149.351 in House Bill 9. So apparently the legislature knows what they're doing when it comes to 149.351 with the destruction statute. Otherwise, there would have been a need to revise it. They would have touched it at the same time they touched House Bill 9. I believe that the intent is clear.
Did that predate this case, or is that post?
Oh, that was just introduced last month. So it's that was in response to issues that occurred with public records requests this past summer. But
did the other, did the other purposes served by these documents to which you referred, do they meet the definition of documents, records that document the organization, functions, policy, decisions of?
Absolutely, sir. I don't believe there's any question as to that. I don't believe that was ever even questioned at the trial court level. These document sick time, vacation time. This would be used for FMLA determinations. It would be used, again, for overtime. And another reason why each document counts in this case is because this became a case under the FLSA, where every document was required to prove the FLSA damages. The compilation sheet was useless for determining FLSA damages because it did not record if somebody was absent for an entire day. For FLSA, you go by a 40-hour week, not an 8-hour day. If somebody was absent due to sick time on a Tuesday, that would not be recorded on the singular compilation sheet, and you wouldn't know it by that. But somebody would have to accrue over 40 working hours that week. That is why in this particular case, every single document that said why somebody was out and for how long they were out was crucial to proving the overtime charges under the FLSA.
Counsel, you've made a very articulate argument as to why each of these documents is a record within the meaning of the statute. But it's specific to your case. We're asked to answer this abstract question. So what is your one or two sentence answer to the abstract question?
Well, let me preface. I think the overlying question here is the violation aspect of this, not the record aspect. That's where everybody's going to. It's the, we're okay with these being records for the sake of being records, but heaven forbid they be records for the sake of constituting what is a violation. And again, unfortunately, that's a question that wasn't taken up by this court. The Sixth Circuit is going to have to deal with it. My opinion is that there is adequate case law to say that there were 860 violations of the statute. But we don't need to get to the sky is falling issue. In almost 20 years that this statute has existed as it has, this is the only case that's gotten to this point. There's almost no cases out there where there have been substantial awards under this.
So is your answer that there isn't an answer?
No, I'm sorry. Let me go back. I apologize. I didn't mean to totally avoid the question. The answer is as to what is a public record. A public record is any document, as it says in the statute. I have no problem with the strict construction of the statute. Is any document, item, or device used to record the activities of that office? These, very simply, fall within that definition. You can stop, in my opinion, you can stop that definition after the fourth word.
So the answer to the question is to read the statute back to the Sixth Circuit.
Yes.
So you would say 149.011G, which is records plural. You would say the definition for records plural is the definition for records singular under the forfeiture law. Is that
not
right?
Not necessarily. I think this is the difference. There are two definitions we are looking at this, not record and records, but records under 149.011 and the definition of a public record. A public record is a subset of the definition of records. Records is the broad definition that applies it for the entire chapter. And goes forth. Then
where do you find the definition for public record?
Right. Public record then is
where is
narrow.
The definition?
Oh, I'm sorry. I believe that is 149.43A. Public record, singular, mind you, means records, plural, kept by any public office, and then it goes on. I don't believe that there is a willy-nilly approach to singular or pluralness. I believe it is very deliberate. Records was used within the initial definition section. Records plural is referred to within the definition of a public record. It is a narrowing of the general definition. It sets out the exclusion. It makes many qualifications on this. It's not inconsistent. Also, remember, 1986, when 149.351 was revamped, when they revised all the penalty statutes accordingly, they deliberately changed 149.351 from being in the plural to being in the singular, which is why the district court very much focused on that. And they said, yes, we believe that that's how they got to the violation is per record, not per act of destruction, because of the legislature's deliberate change from the plural to the singular. Justice Pfeiffer, I do want to address one issue that you asked Mr. Christensen. You asked him if there was any fight at trial about this issue. Now, Mr. Christensen was not trial counsel. I don't know if he was there at any point in time, but he was not trial counsel. The answer is no. If you go back and read through our brief, I cited several instances where counsel for the city of Akron basically interchanged the words documents and records. In his own words, the number is in the documents. That was part of his closing argument to the jury.
Did they object to the instruction, though, that was given?
I'm sorry?
Did they object to the instruction that was given?
There was no instruction as to public records. It was never an issue. The definition was as to what is a violation. That was the issue. As is a violation.
Was that objected to?
I'm sorry?
Was that instruction?
That was objected. In the city's opinion, the act of picking up a bunch of papers, throwing it in the garbage, is a violation, is an act of destruction. Whereas the plaintiff's position, and the district court agreed with us on this, was that each record destroyed, and this goes back to changing the definition in 1986 from the plural to the singular, that each record destroyed is an individual violation of the statute. There was never any argument, none whatsoever, as to whether or not each of these individual 860 pieces of paper was an independent record under Ohio's public record statute. Never any argument. So that's what happened at the trial court. Again, going back to the purpose of these records, this form over function argument that we have, again, there are multiple purposes to these documents, and every document was necessary to prove the plaintiff's underlying case. I think it's important to realize that this case came about solely because of an illegal overtime compensatory time program instituted by the specific department the plaintiffs worked in. Because of that, because of these forms generated by that department, every department had single meaning. I think a case on point on this is the Dupuy case in 2002, where the court decided that a single document within a court file, a settlement agreement, was an independent record. They did not say it was part of a record. The court file itself was not the record. The one singular document that had independent meaning was the record within that case. I also believe that the interchange, or I'm sorry, let me back up, the financial ruin argument posed by the city is unwarranted in this case. As we said, for 20 years, this hasn't happened. So apparently the cities are dealing with it. However, this is a case where there was mass destruction, willful destruction, to thwart a lawsuit. The jury found malice
in this case.
You need to sum up
your red light, huh?
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that was up. Well, thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ms. Corso. Mr. Christensen, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to focus on the forfeiture aspect of this, that it is in derogation of the common law that municipalities cannot have punitive damages assessed against them. Therefore, this statute must be strictly construed in the city's favor and against the state of Ohio and the respondents in this case. I'd ask you to adopt the language that I previously set out for what a record is in this case, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.